the Russian tanks came in, and it just so happened that they were shooting up Rakurtsev Avenue. They hit our very small room. Was gone. My bed was gone. Instead of the wall and the balcony and everything, it was a gigantic hole. So my mother said, you know, I think we better go.
We were stumbling over dead bodies. The Russians were shooting. They didn't see us, by the way, but they knew that there are people escaping.
Everybody was convinced that whatever happens, you're most likely gonna die.
Half a century ago, the people of Hungary mounted an armed rebellion against Soviet occupation. It was a revolution forged by teenagers and crushed by the ruthless power of the Red Army.
When I heard about the, came to aware of the uprising, I went, I asked to see the premier. And I told them that, Mr. Premier, I think that we should bring all the Hungarians that we can to Ontario. I said to the premier, I said, who's going to object to refugees? And far from objecting, the letters to the editor just went on and on about let them in, let them in.
The defeated dreamers would flee their homeland in desperation and become the first group of refugees welcomed en masse by the Canadian people, a milestone of acceptance and compassion that changed them and this country forever. Today, amid Canada's multicultural mélange, those once young rebels form a tightly knit community that is notable for its success in the arts, journalism, and business. But their hearts still hold a history of sacrifice and pain. At the end of the Second World War, communist rule spreads across Hungary in an ever-tightening web of repression, confiscation, and Stalinist terror. An era of midnight disappearances and secret prisons.
Well, the secret police was such a network. They had people who would tell on you, and you wouldn't even suspect some of the people, but they were sort of terrified, because they would say, if you don't do this for us, then we will take away your family or something. And hundreds of people were taken like that and transported to labor camps, either in Hungary or maybe even Russia.
When you're 15 years old and you wake up to revolutionary music, you go to bed with revolutionary music. They talk about Lenin, they talk about Stalin. Your political teachings was always there, but you really, they couldn't change my mind about communism.
Then, in the fall of 1956, peaceful demonstrations demanding basic human liberties begin on several university campuses.
We had this meeting at the university in the aula, the big, big entrance place of the Technical University of Budapest. And it was during that meeting that we discussed what we were after. The end result of that was the 14 points, which became the rallying point of the revolution.
In Budapest, thousands of citizens surge into the streets in a passionate wave of solidarity, idealism, and courage. University and even high school students rush to the front lines.
It just escalated into a protest, and then into a serious demands of change.
As the crowd moved towards the Danube, They started shouting, down with the particular government. It was run by a rather grotesque, balding gentleman by the name of Matyas Rákosi. And his really nasty-looking sidekick by the name of Gerő. Anyway, these two people were clearly focused on by the demonstrators who were suggesting that they should step down.
It was just something special that pushed you, pulled you, or made you go and just be part of it.
There was a Hungarian flag up on one of the buildings, and the Hungarian flag in the early 50s had a thing in the middle, which was this kind of a symbol of communism. And somebody had cut this thing out of the center, and it was a big hole, and I thought, well, this is just great.
I was at the parliament in the evening. People were yelling about the star, the red star, which was on the top of the parliament, and they said, shut it down, shut it down.
The radio station was just around the corner from there, and they're all marching towards that, so I just followed, Was I enthusiastic, revolutionary? Absolutely not, but, everybody goes to the right, you go turn to the right, Maybe there's free potatoes, who knows?
I heard Uncle Stalin come down. He came down with a massive crash. And by the time I got there, all that was left of the large statue was his boots. I managed to get a piece of Stalin from my grandfather.
And everyone said that let's go. There was a newspaper, a communist newspaper, which was the official newspaper of the Communist Party of Hungary. Let's go there to demonstrate. And that's 9:30, that was the time when, and then they started to shoot.
Later on that evening, they started shooting at us, the Államvédelmi Hatóság, the secret police. And dispersed this demonstration. A large group went over to the studio and occupied the studio.
I went home, and of course my mother was not very happy about any of this. But I sort of tried to pretend that I hadn't really been anywhere.
I had a date for October the 24th, and I didn't realize that it was a date with history. I just wanted to have a date with a girl. I made my way to my date, kind of going from doorway to doorway for about 20 blocks. I was fighting going on and so forth. And when I arrived at the little patisserie, which was not far from my office in the radio building, I noticed with interest what I first took to be powdered sugar on a tray of pastries, but turned out to be pulverized glass. And showing good common sense, my date didn't show. So after waiting for an hour or so, I walked over to my office and joined the revolution.
To the young rebels, the revolution of 1956 seems to herald a new beginning in a free and democratic Hungary.
The first battle of the Hungarian uprising was actually just outside my office in the radio building. I wasn't there that night, but I came the next morning, and by then the fighting was over, and the radio building was occupied by the freedom fighters. And there was a young freedom fighter sitting in what was my room, trying to put a piece of paper in the typewriter and not quite managing to do it. And I joined the revolution by offering to put the paper in the typewriter for him.
When I came back, everybody wanted to know what goes on. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And immediately, we got to form a revolutionary council. And they elected me, and because everybody was convinced that whatever happens, you're most likely gonna die.
I helped, you know, whenever I was needed, mostly in making what is called now the Molotov cocktail, you know, these bottles with the gasoline and a piece of cloth that we used as a cork, which was lit and then thrown on the tanks. So, but some had to make those, and I was responsible for collecting the bottle. My neighborhood, they were all apartment buildings. There is a court in the middle, and there are the balconies that you the inside of the building. And usually in those buildings, they had a sort of what they call a column, which you banged on it, you know, and then it made a big noise, and everyone comes out because something is being announced. Well, I was banging on it, and then whoever came out, and then I said that the revolution needs your contribution, and if you can't come out and fight, please give us your empty wine bottles. You have to throw it quite fast, you know, and when you throw it, it breaks on the tank, and the gasoline flows all over the tank and burns. And if you threw two or three of them, well, those tanks are not made maybe like the tanks today, so probably some flows inside the tank, and then maybe the inside start to burn, and then those who are sitting in the tank come out, and the tank becomes useless for them.
I had a toy gun, and I put it out the window, and my mother just came flying at me, said, don't do that.
And I did manage to shoot a gun. Again, not particularly successfully, because it was a large gun and I didn't realize that they kicked back. And nobody told me. And so the gun just kind of went off and wham! I clearly wasn't cut out to be a soldier.
I went to the building of the chief of police for Budapest, where there was a group of the leaders of the various revolutionary units meeting to try and organize some coordination, and they wanted a student into it.
The whole town knows, Shorokshahr knew that the anti-aircraft division is on our side, and we also were shooting at Russian planes. You know, that's a good sign.
You could hear the bombs. At one point, there was a soldier that came down, and I was wondering, well, what's a soldier doing down there? And she said, well, he's kind of one of ours. He's defending us.
I remember when our units shot two tanks out, and that was great. It was euphoria.
The new prime minister, the liberal Imre Nagy, takes power and declares Hungary's withdrawal from the Warsaw Pact.
I get a phone call from Imre Nagy, and he wanted to meet me in order to discuss the situation. And I said, fine, I can go. And he said he would like to have me gather some group of representatives of the students who are participating in the revolution, and he is going to send some vehicle for us to go. And we went to see the Communist Party Secretariat in the headquarters of the Communist Party on Alkosmajnica. And in many ways, it was very scary. The entrance was closed by two Russian tanks sort of facing each other. And as we arrived, they pulled aside. They knew we were coming. And we went in and we jumped out. And our vehicle backed out, and then I looked back, and the two tanks closed. There was a holy smoke.
Our main role at Chopin University was the relief shipments started to arrive from Austria, and we were selecting what is urgently needed in Budapest, like any food or especially medication. And this sort of material had to be transported. Now also, some of the students went with the shipments to make sure that it arrives to the right destination.
Most uprisings, wartime situations, revolutions are filled with atrocities, incidents, petty crime, and so forth. And relative to most, the Hungarian uprising was meticulously clean.
A Czech ship has arrived in order to pick up and evacuate the family members of the Soviet embassy staff. And apparently a crowd gathered, and they don't let them board the ship, and they are threatening them. So Béla says to me, the university student's name is golden these days. They listen to you. So take a couple of your student friends and go and stop this nonsense. We looked very much like the heart of the revolution with our tricolor armbands and weapons, so we did have the upper hand. So I stood up and asked for quiet, and there were enough good people in the crowd that they formed actually two lines, and in between them the women and children boarded the ship. And to this day I'm very happy to sort of play this little part in holding up high the standard of our revolutionary zeal.
As statues crumble and Soviet troops pull back, victory seems near. But the dreams of the young rebels are about to be destroyed. After 10 days of pride and defiance on the streets of Budapest, the Red Army returns.
In November, sometimes we no longer got instructions. And that was the biggest problem. The army chaos sets in if there's no commander. You gotta have a strong commander. So local command took over, and we did the way we thought it was fit. Once central command was broken up, that was the end.
Nearly 3,000 men, women, and children are killed in street battles that pit students with bottles and crude rifles against Soviet machine guns and tanks.
At one point, we knew that it was lost, you know, like there was no more, and everything stopped. They didn't come and pick me up, come and help to collect bottles, so it just died out.
The secret police were everywhere, looking for me specifically by name. I was told that a little place where I lived, a secret policeman is living there, waiting for me to come back.
The Russian tanks came in, and it just so happened that they were shooting up Rockwoods Avenue. They hit our very small room. Was gone. My bed was gone. Instead of the wall and the balcony and everything, it was a gigantic hole. So she said, you know, I think we better go.
And the once confident rebels soon are faced with an agonizing choice. Surrender to Soviet vengeance or abandon their homes and families in a desperate dash to the West.
I remember saying that there is only one real distance, and that is the 100 yards between this side of the old Iron Curtain and the other side. All distances are negligible compared to that.
They arrested the head of the student's hostel, and from the prison he sent a message that I must disappear.
Because I was Revolutionary Council, I knew there's only two choices I'm gonna have. I stay here, and then there are two choices. I may go to Siberia, or I may get executed. And both of the other Revolutionary Councilmen who were with me, nobody knows where they are today.
Dinas Miklós, Varga Péter, Keller Károly, Ag Sándor,
Of those who choose to remain, 13,000 will be thrown in prison, and hundreds, including Prime Minister Nagy, will be hanged or shot. In Canada, the Hungarian Revolution is front page news as a proud European nation rises against the merciless superpower. As the casualties mount, letters to newspapers demand action.
I said, there's only one way to find out. Send me over there and I'll be your eyes and ears on the ground. Because he was interested. He was at a very open heart to the immigrants.
With their dream of freedom and their capital city in ruins, 200,000 Hungarians begin an overland trek of hundreds of kilometers to the Austrian border.
I took my pillow and my blanket. And I think I took one toy.
Because I was only, I turned 15 on the 26th of October. I had no documents, because only when you are 16, you had this official document of who you are, where you live, whatever. I had one little photo with my grandmother, which was taken that summer, so 56 June or July, and so I had that picture with me. If I'm caught, I die or something. Well, I have some kind of identification. That's the only thing I had.
We switched over to a cattle car, which I thought was kind of strange. And there was a group of us in the car, but we were told to be very quiet. And what was happening is that as we would pull into a train station, we could see through the slats and notice that there were armed guards out there.
My mother could only afford to buy me one pair of shoes a year, and this was my yearly beautiful. I loved them, and I wasn't leaving behind, so I wore these shoes. Murderous. They were not meant for walking across borders.
We were walking over fields, and I remember my mother had high heel boots on, and of course we were going over frozen ground, and so she was going to leave her little suitcase. And I said, no, you can't leave your suitcase. I picked it up and carried it for her.
I came to the edge of our town with six other officers. And I said, guys, stay here. I'm gonna go see my family. And and I was on my way out. And as my dad was with me, and my father said, you know, that I have five children, and I'm so glad none of you left the country. And I was on my way out. Can you imagine? But I couldn't tell him.
We used to go to the border every night. Often the children had to ride on the backs.
There was moonlight. We were stumbling over dead bodies. The Russians were shooting. They didn't see us, by the way, but they knew that there are people escaping.
In the dark, they couldn't see what was up ahead.
As we were coming to what appeared to be a village, after all the walk and shooting and stuff, we didn't quite know if it was still in Hungary. It was an Austrian village. So we crept up to the nearest house and we listened what language they were speaking.
There were five of us, five boys. The eldest was 18, the youngest, I was the youngest, 15. If I think back, you know, it's just incredible how everything worked out in spite of not even knowing which part of the border we are going to.
We were offered some food when we arrived, and then they said we can just go to a school, and we were sleeping there just on the school benches, putting down our head, and we waited for the morning.
It was all snow, eh? Everything was white. It was end of November, cold. Dark skies, like, you know, it was sort of, it was good for a movie, you know, and as we were walking on this field towards the border, where the border was, we saw some soldiers, and I said, maybe we should go and talk to them. I mean, you know, if you go around, they can come down and, you know, if they want to shoot us, it's no problem. They already can shoot us now. So, I mean, let's go and maybe we should ask where the border is, you know. They told us that it's about 2 or 3 kilometers, it's Austria. You somehow maybe lose a little bit of sense of reality. You say, well, you know, whatever happens now will happen. Like, I mean, well, what can we do now? We there's no way going back.
The first time we got caught by some Russian soldiers, actually, is who they were.
We tried the door and discovered it was open, and we were roaming in the hallways of the prison and tried the main gate and discovered that it was open. And we left, there was absolutely no one guarding us, and we left the jail, went promptly back to the border and crossed it.
So we started to walk and we saw tanks here and there, but nothing, there was no one in the tanks. We saw these observation towers, we actually walked under one, but there was nothing up there either. And then we got to a little sort of very, very small river, maybe, I don't know, 3-4 meters wide. And we went across it. And on the other side, we saw red, white paint on the trees. So we got through towards these trees, you know, with the red and white paint on it. And then we saw a field, a tree, and two men were chopping wood beside the tree. So I said to myself, if we go and ask them, if they answer in Hungarian, then bad news, you know, those white and red, the red and white stripes don't mean much. So actually we went, and then they said, no, no, you're okay, you're in Austria, and just go to the village there and they will give you some food and socks, because by that time I was completely wet. The socks were frozen on my feet, my shoes obviously completely wet.
We arrive and there's a little light there, so we walk up to the house. I'm the only one who speaks German as well, so I volunteer. The other guys held a gun. We still don't know if we're in Austria or not. Think about all the smart army guys. We still don't know it's in Austria. So he opens the door and he said, "Welcome to Austria."
They were so nice, those Austrian villagers. You know, they were so welcoming and so warm and so helpful, and so, like, it's just wonderful to see the goodness in people. I think all those who went to the border and were welcomed, we'll never forget that welcome, because it was after 3 days of worry and stress, and we didn't know what will happen, and then you see these nice people welcoming you and giving you warm socks and hot chocolate and cake. You know, it was just wonderful.
As the young Hungarian rebels swarm across to Austria, tea and pastries soon devolve into the grim reality of life as a refugee.
The revolution, for me, was a hell of a lot easier than being a refugee. Being a refugee is not fun. You know, being a revolutionary, especially if you're, you know, kid 12, and you think, wow, you know, this is exciting, and I'm heroic, and phew, I've got a gun, and what? You know, this is really good stuff. And then you come out, and you're a refugee, and, you know, it's kind of humiliating.
Eisenstadt was a big refugee camp, and I became a translator there. Matter of fact, I tell you who I met there at that time. We had a minister of immigration called Pickersgill, and Pickersgill came to visit. And Pickersgill said, we'll take everybody who wants to go to Canada.
Mr. Pickersgill came to Vienna to look after, to give help to refugees to ease coming into Canada, ease the rules.
How many can a government bring? 10,000 people who could not speak a word of English, penniless.
I met some Italians working on a Greek boat. So I started talking to them. And where are you going? I said, oh, we go to Canada. To Canada, that frozen north? Are you guys crazy? Oh, he said, we go back and forth to Quebec City. I said, well, would you take me with you? He said, okay, but you gotta work. So 11 o'clock at night, I was on the ship. 15 days later in Quebec City.
She said she closed her eyes and pointed to a map, but I think the real reason was that Canada didn't have compulsory military service.
Right in Quebec City, an immigration officer came on. Who are you? I told him, I'm a Hungarian refugee and I like to stay in Canada. Took him 5 minutes. 5 minutes, still had the little paper he filled out, still have it in my documents at home, and they said, welcome to Canada, give me $5.
They were first-class citizens, asked nothing of the government, just a job. That's all they wanted, it was a job.
As winter closes in, the Canadian government makes an unprecedented announcement. Not only will it accept every Hungarian refugee who seeks to come, but it will pay for their passage as well.
Our dean of forestry, when he saw how many of the students came out and how many of the teaching staff came out, he was trying to keep us together.
I knew that I wanted to come here, you know, from what I read about, and I was a stamp collector when I was young, so I often looked up things about the countries that I have stamps from, and what I learned about, I knew it was huge countries, the second biggest country, and very few people, so that appealed to me. I said, there is still place for me there, you know, so I won't have to compete for space.
By the time I left, the pipeline had been established. A real pipeline from the crossing to the barracks to the school and churches to the plains, on the plains. By the time they arrived, the government had either purchased or rented two large buildings, one on Jarvis Street.
We boarded the ship just after midnight. Beautiful boat. We were amazed the first day when we looked about it, heard it was luxurious, but when it started to move, it was a different story.
14 days on the Mediterranean and the Atlantic Ocean, 14 days of sickness for me anyways, because I was sick like, my goodness, I was sick. I didn't eat for 14 days.
Over 37,000 refugees choose Canada. Their paperwork processed at the rate of one per minute. It is the largest number per capita accepted by any country in the world.
4th of January, we arrived to St. John, New Brunswick. They gave us papers and they stamped my little booklet. The train left St. John and went through Quebec City, you know, all these funny names, stations. For a Hungarian to read Quebec, it's quite an exploit because, you know, in Hungarian you don't use the Q that often. And we arrived in Saint-Paul-Hermite, which is close to Montreal, about 25 kilometers, 30 kilometers from Montreal. We were stationed there, and it was a beautiful place, clean, and oh my goodness, the food. I ate cornflakes for the first time. Oh, let me tell you, I loved cornflakes.
The young rebels find themselves embraced by Canadian compassion. It is the beginning of a new era in Canada's relationship to the suffering nations of the world. But the refugees themselves are focused on their own survival.
You get off the boat, where do you go? Where do you go? You don't speak the language, where do you go? Well, there's only two places you go to, either the railroad station or the bus station. It's warm there, and you also meet people there. So I went to the railroad station in Quebec City. I was not very successful finding a job. Keep in mind, if you don't get undressed for 7 days, I only had a little bag, you know, and I had working clothes they gave me on the boat.
Then at the camp, people started to leave, like those who had relatives, those who had job offers, those who had a profession. Like, you know, I mean, it wasn't a camp to stay there forever. It was a camp from which you had to go somewhere. They called me in a room and they said, well, you're 15, you're alone. What are we going to do with you? We just can't let you go. Where will you go? Like, we really don't know what to do with you. Well, I said, it's really not complicated. I said, if you could find a family who would take me in and would send me to school and give me warm socks, I will be very happy. Several families offered that they would take me in for a while. They said, we don't know what to do. Well, I said, if I go 2 days to each family, after 8 days, I tell you where I want to stay. I said, that you solve the problem. So they thought it was original, most probably because now I had the responsibility to make the decision and not them. I went to the second family, and on the second day, I decided that I'm staying here. I'm not even going to explore the two other families. That's where I'm staying.
I got on the train. I went to Montreal. In Montreal, I was a little more successful because somebody told me, go to the car dealerships. You can wash a car, and you get 25 cents a car. Well, I could wash 2-3 cars an hour. So I go down every day, wash the cars, and you know what a loaf of bread cost those days? 17 cents. And a quart of milk, 18 cents. And you know what? With a loaf of bread, quart of milk, you could live.
This family found a school for me, which was one of the best, if not the best, French schools in Montreal. Collège Notre-Dame offered to take me in as a boarder, so I was boarding, eating there, sleeping there all week, absolutely free. And they said they will keep me absolutely free as long as I perform as a student. Let me tell you, I was a good student because not knowing one word of French, January, I think end of January, or maybe let's say 1st of February, I started in 57. In 2 years after, I was the first of my class.
I get off the train and I recognize my uncle. Never seen him, but he looked so much like family resemblance. I said, you must be my uncle. Yes. He said, are you hungry? I said, of course. For 7 weeks, I only had bread and milk.
Those axes will be made.
They'll be made at breakfast.
So we started in the basement and in the garage. Bought one machine after the other. I mean, today we have between 10,000 and 11,000 people. We have 34 plants worldwide. I don't know, it's not difficult.
My father moved to Toronto in 1958, and he tried to find a job. He was running low on money already. The money that he saved, he was spending, and he was looking for a job, and he couldn't find any because he was already considered old. A lot of his friends that he knew from Budapest that had stores or businesses started opening up in Spadina and in Kensington Market, which was called the Jewish Market. And some of his friends told him, Willie, there is a store for rent. And there is an empty space, and the rent was very reasonable. And there were racking in the store, the existing racking that my father was able to use. I mean, his whole rent was $50. Back then, a lot of the Hungarians were professional people, but they didn't have their papers or their certificates, so they were not able to practice in their own profession. And a lot of them, as you know, they became waiters. And these guys needed tuxedos, black pants, shirts. So my father went to Salvation Army and Goodwill, and he took two big bottles of Johnny Walker with him, and he gave that to the manager, and he told the manager, if you have fur coats, tuxedos, black pants, you call me. So my father was getting a lot of calls.
I didn't really settle in until I got the job at McClellan & Stewart. When I got there, I really felt at home. I think it was singular good fortune to work at McClellan & Stewart at a time when it was really the place to be. I mean, it was a decade where Irving Layton and Earl Burney and Al Purdy and Leonard Cohen were publishing wonderful poetry. It was a decade when Margaret Atwood's first novel came out.
I guess I had the child of immigrant syndrome. It's unwritten, but I think it's there. To me, there, as far as I knew, there was three possibilities for a career. There was law, medicine, and engineering, and I chose engineering and carried a briefcase for almost 20 years.
It was dark evening when we arrived in Toronto. My father had no car, and he asked one of his friends to pick us up at the airport. And he took us to Kensington Market right away. He was very proud of his store. And he showed me, son, this is the store. And I was waiting to see a big department store. And there was this tiny little store in Kensington Market. And I said, oh my God, I can't believe this. This has got to be a mistake.
Bill, I got to show you something. I know you're looking for a jacket.
Later on in life, I realized that the important thing was not that how the store looked. The important thing was to be with my father, because I didn't live with him until I was 12 years old.
Half a century after they challenged the Soviet Empire, the young Hungarian rebels of 1956 have passed on their stories to a new generation.
The Shoplan students came out sort of as one big family. And since we came out without our families, we were very important for each other. And each wedding we had, the group was invited. If somebody had a baby, then the godparents were from the student body and so on. Anyway, we started to get together actually after one wedding, which we decided, hey, this was fun. Why don't we do this every year?
Country has been good to us. It's like when you have parents that have been good to you, you don't want to abandon them.
We felt the gratitude towards Canada. We were very grateful that they allowed us to stay together as a group. And somehow we felt that we have to give back something to Canada. Little things like I remember when the first Red Cross blood donation clinic was, so many of us went because we said in 56 the West sent blood to the Hungarian refugees, we should give it back to the Red Cross.
They offered everything, freedom, opportunities, you name it, we got it. You know that with nothing to stand and then we own your own business, that was a big thing.
It's a big story for me because it's my life. I don't think there is anything special about it. What is special, I think, about it, that the way these whole things happened against all odds.
I rather suspect that if events knock you about a bit, it is salutary because you minimally learn to roll with the punches. Any experience that doesn't kill you helps you and makes you more versatile, possibly a better person. So I would highly recommend
uprisings and revolutions as a personal experience to people, including even changes of country and emigration, major traumatic experiences are good for you.
Having been through 56 and having seen what I saw makes me appreciate life more. Mind you, I never expected to live this long, but that's another story.
We had a fire here in 1971 or 1972, and I was more upset than he was. At that time, nobody had insurance in Kensington Market, and of course, we didn't have it either. And this, our store burned down, and I saw him, you know, going through the rubble, and I felt really bad for him. And I said, "Dad, it's too bad." He said, "Son, thank God we got our lives."
What I found as I was growing up, that we had another heritage, and we found that my English friends then became jealous because now they didn't have that extra heritage, that extra language, the extra set of customs.
But the pride, the courage, and the anguish of that brave and cruel October remains embedded forever in their hearts.
It's an absolute disaster happened when you have to leave your home with 50 kilograms per person, everything confiscated, you're treated like an animal, everything taken away from you, you don't know what you're gonna eat tomorrow, but it turned out to be the best thing that happened to us.
Országok sorsa felett döntöttek. Embertelen sorsok. A falujában is alig ismerik. Tökéletesen egyedül, a semmi közepén. Sorsok, emberek, dokumentumfilmek minden hétfőn este. Duna TV, a nemzet televíziója.